Welcome to episode 9 of the Cordyceps Crew, an unofficial podcast for HBO's The Last of Us. My name is Richie, and I'm joined by my partner in crime, Klupp.
Hello.
And today we'll be solving the trolley problem. I guess an iteration of the trolley problem at the end of the day. That's kind of what the finale is, if you think about it. Just added variables. But anyways, this isn't a podcast about the trolley problem. It's a podcast about The Last of Us, which is an award-winning story. First a video game, now a hit HBO series. Each week, we take a deeper look into the new episode, discussing themes, narrative beats, game comparison, and pretty much anything that seems worth talking about. And this week's the last episode. It's the last episode of season one, I should say. First and foremost, just thank you everybody for sticking with us from start to finish. So many people have tuned in, way more than I was expecting, and it makes me real happy. It makes me happy that, you know, we're out here, people are listening to us, and, you know, we've had some conversation started with some listeners, and that's what this is all about for us. It enhances our enjoyment of the series. I don't know, you have anything to add to that?
If you continue to enjoy what we put out, you should definitely rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Music.
Yes, 100%. Actually, I didn't even mention this to you, but we have gotten more ratings on Apple Podcast, and people have left their comments. Most of them are pretty generic, so I didn't think, like, most of them were like, love the podcast or something like that. So I didn't think of, you know, reading them out. Maybe we'll read one out at the end. But thank you for doing that. You know, like, it goes along. I know we have 9 now, 9 or 10. So, I mean, yeah, I know I still know there's more than 9 or 10 of you that are listening. So please keep doing that. Keep it up. We appreciate the support. Absolutely. Goes a long way. If you were wondering, just another separate note, if you were wondering, it's the last episode of this season, and things are going to take a while for season 2 to pop up. What are these guys going to do? Well, we've got plans. We have a roadmap that Klupp has spent some time putting together, and I kind of just said, yep, looks good. But yeah, we have a tentative plan for the next month or so for things that we're going to do. But if you want to give us suggestions on things you'd like to see us cover, mostly adjacent stuff, other post-apocalyptic stories, or, maybe like, or movies, books, video games. It's not necessarily all going to be like about a video game adaptations. Those are things that we could cover, and we can kind of either compare or contrast, or just dedicate it all to one specific thing. So if you have any other suggestions, totally open to them, but you can email us at cordycepscrew@gmail.com, and maybe we will take that suggestion and cover it for you. Anything else you want to say about that?
Yeah, just some sneak peek stuff that we have planned. We'll do an entire recap of season one. We'll do an episode throwing out some bold predictions for season two. We'll do another episode with our favorite casting choices for important roles in season two. Obviously, those will be very spoiler heavy. And then we're going to do an episode where we're going to actually break down some of the science behind Cordyceps in real life and kind of rewrite The Last of Us based off of how it would be if the science was portrayed as 100% accurate, which I think will be a lot of fun. And at one point in the future, we will replay The Last of Us Part 1. Maybe we can do a kind of replay together with any listeners that want to kind of play along with us on a week-to-week basis. But that's some of the stuff we have planned in the future. And that's all I'll have to say about that. So keep listening if you want to hear any of that cool stuff.
Yeah, the future is bright. We've got stuff that we can do, and things that we can explore together as a community, if you will. So I'm excited for that next chapter of the podcast. But yeah, we got episode 9, the finale, which was Look for the Light, which I liked that it wrapped. Episode 1 was When You're Lost in the Darkness, and episode 9 was Look for the Light. I kind of like the fact that they wrapped that together. That was kind of a neat little call to the iconic phrase of the game. Just a quick summary of what goes down in this episode, in case you forgot. A pregnant Anna places her trust in a lifelong friend, and we learn about the details that lead to Ellie's immunity. Joel tries to comfort Ellie in his own way after a difficult trip to the hospital. There's a giraffe, so that helps. And once reaching the hospital, Joel must make a decision that could alter the course of humanity, but more importantly, his relationship with Ellie. This is a heavy episode to a heavy show. So I can't wait to break down what goes down here. And probably one of my favorite endings to a story, maybe ever. For me at least, I really love the ending to this story. I don't know what that says about me, that I like somewhat sad and bittersweet endings, but we'll talk about that at the end. So let's start with the beginning. We get a flashback of Anna and Marlene. Anna is Ellie's mother, played by Ashley Johnson, who was the voice actor for Ellie in the games. And Ashley Johnson, we're a big fan of Ashley out here, Critical Role represent. Anna is, this was a cool addition to the series, because we don't get this. Anna is referenced. I don't even know if her name is, I don't think her name is even referenced in the game. Obviously we know Ellie has a mom, but she, that's about all we know, you know, that she existed and she didn't make it through, this, post-apocalyptic world. And, we get a little bit of a story here. So what are your thoughts about this inclusion? What were your main takeaways from this introduction?
I thought it was important, I think, to show a little bit more of how the Ellie Marlene relationship came to be. We get hints at it in the games and the show, and in the games, that's all we ever really get, are hints. But I think it's interesting to learn that Marlene has a deeper emotional connection to Ellie than we originally anticipated, because it gives the events that happen later that much more weight. I also think it's a great opportunity to bring Ashley Johnson in, because the series wouldn't exist without, you know, Ashley Johnson. The character of Ellie wouldn't exist without Ashley Johnson. Yeah. And giving her time to write a tiny love letter to the character of Ellie in her own way is, I think, really great. And it's a really tense scene. I think it's well shot. I like the moment when Marlene finds her in the house and she has the knife against her own neck. That's a really great little bit of tension building. I think it's a beautiful little moment. And it's a worthy addition to The Last of Us canon in terms of the scene addition, but also the lore implications that it provides.
Yeah, I think that's the main addition that it brings too. There is something very strange yet kind of like beautiful that Ashley is the one that brings her own character into the world. It's kind of like
a beautiful little metaphor, I think.
Yeah,
a very meta metaphor.
Yeah, it is. It is for sure. it is. I mean, if you know anything about Ashley Johnson, you know how much this character means to her. I mean, she said that if, you know, in the games, like if they ever, you know, make future games, she needs to be at like Ellie. Like that is her. Like that is her character. So I would imagine it's pretty hard for her on some levels to see somebody else play the character, but I think that she's ultimately really enjoyed Bella Ramsey's rendition of it. And this is the interesting introduction here. And the main difference is that we don't really know in the games why Ellie is immune. And we get a sense here, I guess we don't know for sure, but we have a pretty good idea that the reason why Ellie is immune is because her mother was infected as she was being birthed, essentially. That there's this kind of weird interim period where she's, you know, connected, you know, through, you know, umbilical cord, whatever, placenta, whatever. And, you know, the biology of that has somehow created this like in between phase where she's kind of infected and she's kind of not. And I've seen a lot of discussion about this. I wanted to ask you about this in the community that some people don't like this. Some people like the idea that the magic of her immunity is left unknown. And they're not a big fan of the fact that it's something that's repeatable, which I think is kind of nonsense. I mean, like, it's not really like, I guess the sense that you can basically take a pregnant woman and be like, okay, we're going to infect you while you're giving birth so that we can create another immune child. I don't know. To me, that just doesn't play, and I don't see the characters of the world figuring that out. I don't know. Is that something that you also kind of picked up on, or?
Well, first of all, there's nothing biologically to suggest that it would be repeatable. I mean, we don't know if Ellie harbors some kind of unique genetic mutation that, you know, makes her predisposed to be able to survive whatever amount of fungus was transferred, you know, and not quite in utero, but, you know, via the placental connection. So that's the great thing about biology. It's so variable. Sometimes it's hard to explain. So the thing is, in the science fiction of Ellie's immunity is never explored, and it's important in a narrative sense. It's important in the way that, you know, she's important as a quantity to different characters, but obviously the scientific nature of her immunity is never quite explored because the people who are said to do that are all dead now. So yeah. The Ellie's immunity is a facet of narrative of the narrative, and a piece of personal interactions with her and other characters. It's a piece of Ellie herself as a character, but, you know, the science fiction of it, the biology of it, the lore around it, it's all incidental. And so whether you know why it exists, whether or not, even if you could look me in a straight face and claim you can explain that based off of that little scene, then, you know, I'm sold. But basically, I don't think it really matters. I think it's cool that we have some semblance of an explanation of it, but it doesn't really matter either way. So why not show it? It gives a great moment to give some context to Ellie and the way she fits into the broader world. So yeah, I think it's a positive rather than a detractor.
100%. Yeah, I agree. Listen, you're not going to hear me complain very much if you give me additional additional story to something that already exists, right? Like, very rarely am I going to say that that's detrimental, like giving additional details to a story that we care about so much so that we've started a podcast about it. So, I'm cool with it, for sure. We jump forward back to the present, and we see Ellie that is definitely changed. There's definitely something going on there with Ellie that, for which we know why. I mean, she just had a really traumatic experience with David.
Yeah, I think this is the piece. Well, last week we talked about one of the endearing things about Ellie is that at her core, she's still kind of a not naive child, but still carefree in a way that so many people in this world are not allowed to be. And David kills that piece of her. And we now have to see that version of Ellie. And it's not fun for her. It's not fun for us that one of her most redeeming qualities and something that's very beautiful and pure about her is no longer there. But it's ironic because at the same time, a piece of Joel that's been missing for a long time has been restored by his relationship to Ellie. You know, he has never been carefree as long as we've known him. He's always been saddled with the responsibility of taking care of another human being. But for so long, he, you know, for 20 years now, he hasn't been able to do that successfully. And now he's, you know, basically fulfilled his purpose. And that's given him life back in a way that we haven't known Joel for 20 years. Really, the glimpse that we saw him at the beginning of episode one, maybe even not even then. So it's interesting. You have these kind of diametrically opposed character fulfillments here at the beginning of this episode. And clearly it just kind of flips their entire character dynamic on a head for the first 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of an interesting dynamic that plays out throughout the entire series is that they're almost never on the same page. Like they're constantly, you know, taking steps forward and then one of them is taking steps back. And it's like, it's this complete, I think it makes it very not frustrating for us as a player, but like, you know, we want to see them right form that connection and form that relationship. And we see it happening in bits and pieces, but it's almost prolonged because they're just constantly on different levels. And I think
that makes them realistic and consistent characters, yeah. Though. I think that's why they're so good as characters, because they act in flawed, unexpected ways like real people would.
Exactly. Like that, we got, you know, Joel's ready to cook up some Chef Boyardee and play some Boggle, you know, and Ellie's, you know, like, you know, don't, not right now, man.
Yeah.
it's a tough moment for sure.
I wanted to ask you a question. I think the show Joel is portrayed a lot very different than game Joel in a good number of ways. And one of them is, I think, his base personality at its very core. I think unburdened, you know, kind of whole Joel in the show plays off a bit goofier, a little bit more lighthearted, certainly has more of a personality than game Joel, who seems, you know, by necessity of the game is a little bit more of a blank slate, so you can project on that. Did you pick up on that at all here and just throughout the season in its entirety?
I definitely think he's definitely not as I don't want to like undersell it by saying just serious. I mean, like, I don't think he is as serious in the show as he is in the game. I think he's very much more level-headed and kind of, I mean, there's a thing about Joel in the game where he doesn't really know how to express himself that well. And I think a lot of the time that comes across as him just like being this hardened man, that this hardened exterior. And I think a lot of it is more like him struggling through, you know, dealing with the trauma of losing his daughter and losing these people that are really close to him. But also just, you know, he's not good. He's not an expressive guy. I mean, we've seen it even in the show too. Like, he has a tough time like consoling Ellie in episode 4 or 5, where she, right after she kills, has her first kill, quote unquote, with the gun. He's not good at consoling her. Like, he doesn't know what to say or how to say it. And I think that I do pick up on those serious moments with him, but I do think you're right. Like, I mean, like, he's definitely a little bit more goofy as well in the show. Like, you don't have these moments like of Chef Boyardee, and, you know, he makes a joke later in this episode about having dynamite to blow up the path so that they can move forward. And it's just a big joke to him. And, you know, I do think that there is a little bit of this lightheartedness. I don't know if that's maybe to provide like some comic relief, but usually that's Ellie's role. So I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. It just at its very core in the show, he's just more talkative. Like, he just says more. Even in the games at this point, when Joel is a bit more whole and a bit more relaxed, he still doesn't say a lot. And even if you can tell he's lightened up because he, you know, might make a lighthearted offhand remark here or there, he's not, you know, breaking quips or, you know, kind of going off as much as this Joel does. I think it's interesting.
Well, it goes back to something you said, I think, a few episodes ago. I mean, you said that in the game, right, you play as Joel for pretty much 90% of the game. And that basically means that, I mean, sometimes they don't give as much of an impression of Joel because it's meant for you to fill in those blank spaces.
Yeah, you as the player.
You as a player. And I think they filled in those blank spaces in the show with a little bit more of this, like, dad mode. You know what I mean? Just like, yeah. like trying to be like, fill the moments of like awkwardness with, you know, a dad joke or something funny or something that we could all relate to. Right. As opposed to making your own conclusion. So I think it's probably a bit of that too. I think that was a very good thing that you had pointed out a few episodes ago. And I think it's relevant here as well. Just before we leave here at this moment, I do want to talk about the, like, Ellie just post David, and just the, in terms of the game, what's happening in this moment is it might be like hard to understand, like, that games don't really like do this a whole lot, where a character will, like, throughout the game you're giving Ellie instruction of, you know, what to do. Like, what makes the game a game is you solve these puzzles together, these environmental puzzles. You might tell Ellie to grab a pallet that's in the water because she can't swim, and you'll drag her across the pallet, and or grab a ladder, or boost her up to grab a ladder, and so that you can get to the next area. And throughout the game, it's, you know, you'll say something to her and she'll respond. Like, she'll have a quip, or you'll ask her to do something for you and she'll go and do it.
Yeah. And there's one button input and there's one output, and it's fairly invariable where that's concerned.
Right. And this is pretty common in, I mean, it's been made common by games like this, like The Last of Us. And in this moment where, you know, you have Ellie in this traumatized state, she's not responding to you. You press the button to say, Ellie, do the thing, and she doesn't do it. And, or you start talking to her as Joel and she's not responding to you. And I just think it's worth mentioning, and maybe we'll talk about it more when we do the playthrough, but I do think that they captured it well in this episode, where, you know, it's just like a sad, like, you know why she's this way. And it's like, I'm glad that they paid attention to detail here and made sure that they captured that feeling, because I think it's, especially, you know, in between episodes, it's easy to, you know, forget what happened, you know, even like that, like keep the tone the same. And I'm just appreciative that they add these little details like that.
I mean, if anything, I think it's easy. It's kind of easy to capture that in cinema or television, just because of the way the medium works. In video games, you know, if your game, you know, pauses, you're not actively interacting with the game, there's nothing in the game's code that says, well, just keep talking here. The game is not going to give you more dialogue or more output if you're not giving it input, right? Which is why it's so interesting in the game, where they basically, like, codify Ellie's despondency. Like, if you before that, if you interact with her, she'll interact back. And to have a basically like an NPC, a piece of code that refuses to respond to you because the character is, you know, traumatized and despondent, like, that is such a brilliant piece of game design. That, you know, I think that's a pretty easy, you're right. It was so important for them to get that across here. But really, I think it's a testament of the game, of how well that comes across in the game, that it was, you know, it was a layup for them to do that in the show.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and it's like the game's version of like an alternative version of like showing and not telling, right? It's like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and I think that it hits a little bit harder, and games just don't, like, they just typically don't do that. I thought it was really cool. It's definitely worth mentioning. We'll probably mention it again when we go through the game.
Definitely will. But then there's a moment when you boost Ellie up in the game, and Joel does it in the show. He boosts Ellie up, and then she says, "Oh my God!" and she runs away, and you're left to wonder what's going on. And so, you know, in the game, in the show, Joel follows Ellie to see where she's running off to, and what does she find?
She finds a lovely tall giraffe. Totally unexpected the first time I played it, and I gotta tell you, this is easily up there, if not the most iconic moment in the game and in this series.
Easily.
And it's, I'm so glad that they executed this the way that they did. I will venture to say, and I can't believe I'm gonna say this, I actually think that I like the show version better than the game version, even though I think my initial reaction obviously will never be the same as when I saw it in the game. But I think just side by side, if you put them together, I think that there are some things in the show that they do that are not in the game, and or they couldn't have done in the game. So I think it's the facial expressions that Pedro Pascal does in a couple of these scenes. Let's talk about what the scene means for us individually, because I think it's easy to just see it for what it is, you know, like an interesting moment where they both see a giraffe. But I think that it holds a really important, like this climactic moment for our character here. And I think it's almost really for Joel and Ellie together, but like primarily Joel for me, because I think this is, for me, the moment where Joel makes his quote-unquote decision, right? And he decides that Ellie is his daughter, really, right? Like, that, it's, you could see it kind of in his face in this scene where, you know, she's interacting with the giraffe, she's feeding the giraffe this part of the tree, and he's smiling, and as she's feeding it, his smile kind of fades to, like, this realization. And he decides in that moment, what the hell are we doing going to this hospital? Why are we doing this, like, in the first place, right? And he decides to give her, you know, he decides to tell her, like, hey, like, we don't have to do this, you know? We can just go back. We can go back to Tommy's and we go to Jackson. And, you know, none of this has to be our way forward. You know, we could just live happily there. Ellie's got ideas of her own, but that for me is why this scene is so important, because I think it's the defining moment of Joel's character where he, you know, he doesn't make the decision to save Ellie in the hospital. He's already made up his mind. It's not a decision by the point we get to the hospital. It's a no decision there.
That's really, because that is, my takeaway is a little different. Mm-hmm. Although I think it's a really interesting point, and I agree that Joel's mind is probably made up. I would venture to guess that Joel's mind is made up when they leave Jackson. At that point is when he wouldn't let anything happen to her after that. For me, this scene is all about Ellie. Ellie, who has been traumatized, who's had a piece of her stolen, a piece of her killed, and just like the rest of this world, has been left ravaged by monsters. Whether, you know, fungal infected monsters or the depraved heart of man, Ellie has lost a piece of herself. And in this moment, this entirely unexpected moment where you come across a piece of just untouched, serene beauty in the heart of this kind of disgusting, desolate world, shows that, I mean, more or less, life goes on. Like, even when the world is made low and, you know, so much horror and depravity and desperation has been allowed to take over, even in the face of all of that, hope can endure and life can endure and life can move on. And I think one really important part is, especially in the games, you can take the time and watch. There's a whole herd of giraffe that you can kind of just watch. And it's just this really beautiful moment. And I think it's a moment when Ellie finds the strength to go on. And although she's lost a piece of herself, she sees this and it becomes a symbol of her resolution and resiliency. And Joel, I think you're part of you is probably right. I think the scene probably means two different things to the two different characters. But for Ellie, you know, this is her moment to go on. I think at that point, if she hadn't experienced this and Joel had convinced her to go back to Jackson, she would have returned to Jackson a broken woman. But instead, a piece of her is restored in this moment. And because of that, they have the impetus to continue on. And of course, that's going to set in motion everything that happens. Mm-hmm. But for me, this moment is more important to Ellie than it is to Joel.
I think what we have here is a classic case of we're both a little bit right. I think.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I think I identified more with the former and you identified more with the latter, but I think you're 100% right. And it's kind of like, again, like it's within the theme of the fact that these are characters that have different goals, right? Like they have different, like they're not all wholly different, but like Ellie still wants to realize this purpose of, you know, being important and being something that's bigger than herself. Right. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the final scene, but that's, you know, she, like you said, she is driven in this moment to keep on going and keep on, you know, fighting for this ultimate thing.
And what she says is so important. It can't all be for nothing. Right. And she's not just talking about her voyage with Joel. She's talking about everyone that she's lost. And of course we learn that later, but I think this is, you know, we are both right because this is the moment where it crystallizes. Joel's purpose has always been to make sure is now crystal clear without a doubt. Nothing can happen to Ellie. You know, that was ostensibly his purpose the whole time, but who knows how committed he was, you know, until the journey continued on. At this point, Ellie's purpose is, I need to see this through to the end for me, for my mom, for Riley, for everyone I've lost and everyone who hasn't had a chance. And so at this point, their purposes become crystallized and it sets them on opposite paths. So everything that happens to the two of them and will happen throughout the next season or two, I think it really crystallizes in this moment that their paths are set in diametrically opposed directions.
So Joel, not specifically mentioned in the game. Well, this scene with Joel where he talks about trying to kill himself, this doesn't happen in the game here, like not really at all. He does relate to it in kind of this hidden interaction that you can find if you're a thorough investigator in the game, where Joel and Ellie come across this family who commit suicide in their bed.
Like it's two people in a bathtub.
Oh yeah,
in the hotel in Pittsburgh, and they find the dead bodies, and Ellie's mentions that being the easy way out, and Joel says, trust me, it ain't that easy.
Yeah, so it's kind of implied that he had tried, or at least was close to somebody who had tried to kill themselves. But here we get a little bit more context to that. And I really like that they added this. It's a scene that I think just shows how broken Joel was by losing his daughter. I mean, it's not that surprising, obviously, but
it just shows. We did a whole mailbag on it.
Yeah, we did. We did. And, you know, it actually kind of gives us a little bit of a timeline, right? Because he says that he did this on the second day. So breakout day happened, and then second day he tried to take his own life. And so we kind of have an idea. It was Jeffrey, I think, that asked the question of, you know, what he did in the aftermath of losing Sarah. So it's, again, like I said, I'll never be somebody who complains about adding backstory to a character, especially when it provides a really, like, a really touching moment between Ellie and Joel here, because he tells her that, you know, it's not time that heals all wounds, it's people. And I think that's a theme of the show, and it's definitely a theme between these two characters.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, it adds, again, another layer to Joel that is always implied to be there, but I think some people miss it because of how, as you're playing the game, how heavily players project onto Joel. I mean, players project their own strengths and weaknesses, their own aspirations, their own personalities on this character. And so if you're the kind of person who could never contemplate taking your own life in a moment of weakness, then no, Joel would have never think about committing suicide. No way. That's not Joel. But then again, a piece of you is Joel. So if you're not able to conceive of that, then Joel is neither. So I think it's important that it's written in black and white that, yes, this is something he did and at his lowest point in his devastation. And he wasn't able to do it at the last minute. He flinched. And who knows why, but yeah, it's an important piece of Joel's character that was kind of always there. And I think it's really important that the show brought it to light. We get a little bit more. So actually in the games, you know, speaking of differences, here we have a couple minutes of lighthearted banter before they're captured by the Fireflies. In the games, this is one of the biggest combat gauntlets of the game. You go into the tunnels outside this bus depot and fight the most infected you do in the entire game. There's three bloaters in this area, whereas before you only ever have to fight one maximum. There's probably six or seven clickers and like 10 or 15 runners. It's a very, very challenging section of combat that is obviously, you know, completely omitted here in the show. Do you care about that at all?
Nope.
Or yeah, I don't either. I just thought it was interesting to point out.
Yeah, not at all. I think the story just doesn't need it, right? It's, you know, yeah. The story is wrapping up and all the conflict that we need is through the decisions that are made in this final this final segment of the story. So yeah, I think it's totally fine that it's not here. I think the only time where, like I said last week, I think the only time where I think they should have had infected where they didn't was Ellie and David
At the mill. Yeah.
At the mill. Yeah. I think that was the only time where I was like, ah, I kind of wish they had put infected here. I think it actually held a narrative purpose. I agree.
Yeah, I think, you know, and game pacing and show pacing works differently, and it works. The pacing works in the games. I don't think it would have worked in the show here. Yeah. And I still agree with you on that point. So, but yeah, regardless, they're captured by Fireflies and brought to St. Mary's Hospital.
I did like that little cinematic,
a little flashbang.
Yeah. That was kind of, that was kind of cool that you could see them kind of lurking behind and coming up behind them as Ellie's reading puns to Joel. That was, I don't know. It's a small thing, a small detail again, but I did like that. Yeah. But yeah, let's talk about Marlene and Joel in the hospital. Like you were saying, I want to talk about like this initial interaction between Marlene and Joel, because they interact with each other a couple times in the hospital, but I think that this first one is more impactful, at least in my opinion. It's where she explains to Joel what's going on with Ellie, why she's immune, and what they're going to do. The inciting incident of the whole finale here, right, is Ellie is going to go to surgery, and the surgery is going to cure humanity, maybe, possibly. But it's also going to kill Ellie. It's going to save humanity, but kill Ellie. And I want to talk about like what assumptions Marlene has of Joel at this point, because I think it's the biggest mistake that Marlene makes, right? Is underestimating Joel's relationship. And I think it blows up in her face quite literally.
Jesus. Yeah.
So I don't know. Do you want to talk about it at all? Or
I mean, this is where we get into, the discussion of right and wrong. I think we can start that here. And we obviously will talk about what Joel does. I mean, we know what Joel does, but it's so important to know, like, in this world, everyone has different priorities and different assumptions and different things that they need to do to continue living, where living and surviving are one of the only things you really can do, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly, like, you know, Marlene had a relationship, a strong relationship with Ellie's mom. But Marlene is not just a person trying to survive. She's also the leader of like a rebel group. And in her mind, her responsibility is the restoration of order in America. Her purview and her, priority expands so much farther than just Ellie. Even though she cares for Ellie deeply, allegedly, just like she cared for Anna. Whereas Joel's world is one person. Marlene's world is perhaps the entire world. Every remaining human being that's not infected. Mm-hmm. Joel's world is one person. And if you are the kind of person who's dialed in to see the broader picture, you might miss or underestimate any day of the week the kind of person that has a much more narrow scope. Because it's easy to say, like, how could you, you could say this about political views or day-to-day activities or careers or anything. It's so easy to say, this is what I think. How can you not think this? That's classic cognitive bias or cognitive dissonance right there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Marlene's kind of, the worldview is very broad, but unfortunately it is definitely a miscalculation that she makes.
That and the fact that she selfishly kind of, she puts Ellie into this surgery, right? Because, I mean, in a way, it is selfish. Even though the intent is Ellie will help save the world, you might say, how can a decision like that be selfish? But the fact that she does so without telling her, which, I mean, in terms of, like the medical world, that's, like, completely, I mean, you just wouldn't do this at all, number one. But,
I think that's the thing, though. There's so many rules of morality that are rewritten in this world, and we see that every time. And again, us projecting our morality onto this world just doesn't work, right?
Yeah,
100%, like, yeah. I think a good example, and this might be controversial, but the cannibalism in episode 8. I'm not saying like going out and murdering and eating people, but like if you're in a group of people and one of them is killed by someone else, you are starving. Your family is starving. You're watching your, you're watching your brother, your daughter starve in front of you. The only food left is someone that died of natural causes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the choice is eat them or watch your loved ones die. Yeah, that's a horrible decision, but like you can't with some certainty say, oh, I would just, let my wife die. I would let my daughter die in front of me because I refuse to cross the line into cannibalism. Like that's not an easy decision to make if, the people that you love most in this world can be saved by one action, as detestable as that action may be in a previous life,
It's
and
true.
So that kind of like level of morality, I think Marlene crosses that border. She definitely violates HIPAA a little bit, but what is that against potentially the entire world?
I think it's one of it's just one of the many things in this the story that just makes it as it draws me in as much as it does, because I just love, I've said it a million times, I just love the moral paradoxes that this show throws at you. time and time again. And this was
I'm curious to hear what you have to say about this. So we'll talk about what Joel does real quick. I'll throw out what Joel does, and then I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Because this conversation's been rekindled. Joel is let free by Marlene and decides not to take his life, or, you know, not to take the opportunity and go on with his life. He turns around and he kills basically every Firefly standing between him and Ellie. And it's a really interesting, the way it's shot is really interesting, because in the game, obviously, you're just going on a killing spree. This, it's slowed down. It's a little blurry. They play tragic music over it because we know the Fireflies are people with families and loved ones. And, you know, none of that matters to Joel. And he does what it takes to get to Ellie. The question that's floated was Joel right to do any of this? Now, I have an answer myself, but that's this question that so much discourse has resprung up. Is like, was Joel justified in his actions?
Right.
What do you think?
I mean, it's like, like we said, like the morals of this world are very different. I mean, like, I think so, right? I mean, like, in a sense, I think that if he assumes that he's this protector of Ellie and that she's effectively, you know, his daughter, and that it's his responsibility to protect her, then yeah, I think it's morally justified. I mean, it's so hard to define, because obviously we know as human beings with logic, right? We know that killing people is bad, right? Like that's what we say, but like, That's why I mentioned the trolley problem in the beginning, because that is the premise of the trolley problem, right? Is if, you know, it throws this paradox at you of, you know, you have no choice. You have to kill somebody in this scenario. You know, which one do you choose? Like, you are already going to be morally unjustified, but you have to choose which one is better. And I think it's like, if you're already in a lose-lose situation for Joel, it is the right thing to do. You have to save the person that means so much to you. Letting her die and just accepting her fate, being like, oh, I guess she is important for the world. Like, it just doesn't work for him. Like, you know what I mean? It would be wrong for him as a person, if that makes sense.
What you said is I think the key is like, in a world where personal survival is basically paramount, or, you know, like preserving you and your loved ones is all that matters. It's like, yeah, what matters, what you do is the right thing. Like, so many people trying to superimpose like the morals, our morals and modern day philosophy into a post-apocalyptic world, it just doesn't work. And so I think in the end, it's not, was he right? The whether you assign a right or a wrong is almost irrelevant. It's, you know, what do his actions mean, and what are they going to do? Kind of like, what are the consequences of his actions? Because there's nothing really but just action and consequence in this world. And ultimately, you know, where you think it slides on the moral scale is almost irrelevant. So
yeah,
I think as you know, blasé as that sounds, it's kind of like, I mean, if Joel had just walked away, let's just play this out. Like, Marlene, without Ellie's express consent, you know, basically consigns her to death. There's no way of knowing whether this would work or not, you know, scientifically. Let's say it doesn't, and there's no purpose for finding a cure. Then Marlene's murdered Ellie. She's taken away Joel's only real reason to live. So she's basically killed Joel too. So now Marlene's killed two people wantonly, and every person that she's killed inadvertently by trying to get Joel and Ellie here is also, their blood is also on Marlene's hands. Right.
Yeah.
So You know, and if the vaccine works, you know, then yes, Joel just did something horrible. But considering, like, you know, logistics of production and everything, like, who knows the scope of what the Fireflies would be able to do? There are so many built-in assumptions to say one outcome is right or wrong that you could build what ifs all day. You could build a castle of what ifs and build a parapet of morality. It doesn't mean anything because there's so many underlying assumptions that ultimately, you know, Joel did what he needed to do to preserve his world, and his world is Ellie, and Marlene's world is everyone. And they, you know, they had their own diametrically opposed visions, and one came out on top, and it's kind of as simple as that. Yeah.
There's not that many people left to judge anyways in this world.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's like, I think that's got to come into the decision as well. It's a very different, like you said, it's a very different world, right? Like, I think that even in this current world, I think that most people it's very easy to sit from the outside as a viewer and say, oh, well, I would have done this or that. But like, if you're in that moment, I can't think of many people that wouldn't save one of their loved ones over a bunch of people that they don't know. I think it's I think that would be a minority decision. Most people would not choose that. I think it makes sense. And again, like, you got to stay true to, like, the best characters are ones that do honest and believable things. And I think that it makes sense here. I think it makes complete sense that Joel does this.
And it's tragic. Like, it's ultimately tragic regardless of the outcome. And, you know, we talk a lot about protagonists and, you know, villains. And, you know, again, there's no morally black and white sides. So ultimately, from the Fireflies' perspective, they were about to save the world, and this man came in and ended it all. And, you know, in some lenses, you could view Joel as a villain, and almost certainly, you know, that's going to have consequences. So, you know, it's important to remember that there is no, like, good guys and bad guys. There are just people trying to get by.
People making decisions and living and dying by them. That's basically what this world is all about. It's worth mentioning just how brutal he is by clearing through the Fireflies. I mean,
he's ruthless.
Yeah, he's methodical, right? Like, that's the way that I would describe it, right? It's like, it's just, I guess you have to be, if you're one person against, dozens of people. I mean, he's this methodical, procedural, forgive the pun, but the moment where he comes into the where he gets into the surgery room and just kills a doctor without a second thought. Doctor's like, I won't let you take her, and then bang, just kills a doctor immediately. That's an interesting moment too in itself, because in the game, right, like, you know, that's where you have to make this choice, or it feels like a choice, right? And a lot of people like to fiddle around and you know,
but
take their time making their decision. Yeah. Joel wastes no time in the show.
It's interesting, because in the game, it's not a choice. Like, you have to kill the doctor, and some people don't like that because of how much you're able to project on Joel. And some people are like, oh, Joel wouldn't kill the doctor. He would only kill the other Fireflies. But no, it's a message. Like, Joel, this is what Joel would do. I think this is one of the big points about, like, character autonomy. Like, you can project as much as you want, but this character exists and has their own goals and desires and dreams. And Joel's going to kill that doctor if he's getting in the way of Ellie. And he does.
It's not a full-on RPG.
No. Yeah. Yep.
So
we'll talk a lot about Joel killing the doctor eventually.
Yeah, for sure. That's for another time. Yeah, let's talk about the aftermath, because, I mean, there's two options that Joel can go with here, right? He ultimately gets Ellie out of the hospital and brings her to bringing her back to Jackson. And he's got another choice here, is he could tell Ellie the truth of what happened, or he can lie to her. And he decides to lie to her. So let's talk about this choice and how it changes things between himself and Ellie.
Well, after he brutally murders Marlene,
yes.
You know,
yes, he does.
Which again, probably makes sense for him. Why leave the job unfinished? But it is one of those moments where you see just how ruthless this person is when he needs to assure his world is preserved. Like a lot of us would be, again, I think in that scenario.
Yeah, he says that I can't let you live because you'll literally just keep coming after her. Like my job is to make sure that doesn't happen, and you stand in the way of that, and you've got to go. He's ruthless. He's determined, though. He's definitely determined to see it out.
So the point I made earlier about at the moment where Ellie sees the giraffe and her will is, you know, coalesces a little bit and she's restored and she realizes that she has to see this thing through for better or for worse. Otherwise, her life is forfeit. Her mom's life is forfeit. Riley's life is forfeit. Tess's life is forfeit. You know, all of those people's, you know, their deaths and sacrifices won't be in vain if she sees this through. And I think in a way she is prepared to die if it comes to that. Although I don't think she really think that's going to happen. But like, theoretically, I think if you were to ask Ellie, she would probably say, yes, I'm willing to give it up. Mm-hmm. If it means that all of these people will be saved and redeemed. So the particularly cruel thing about this situation is that Joel realizes that if he tells Ellie the truth and says, I killed all of the Fireflies and robbed you of your purpose in order to make sure that you lived, just because that's what needed to happen for me and for us, you know, it would break their relationship either way.
Right.
You know, at that point, but choosing to lie to her, still, you know, I guess their relationship is able to continue on rocky terms, but you just robbed Ellie of the will that she just found, like that strength in the will that she had just found in that moment. You've taken that back away from her. You've said that this purpose that drove you, that gave you something to believe in, guess what? It means nothing. The Fireflies can't do anything with you. There's lots of people like you and they're all not worth the cure, or they're not, you know, we can't synthesize a cure from them. So the cause is not worth it. Like that's basically like in Joel's mind, you know, he needs to protect the people he loves. So that's basically like restoring Sarah to him only to just kill her like 3 seconds later. Like it's such a cruel reality of what has to happen for them to have any kind of relationship. But like what that does to Ellie is just so fucked up.
Yeah, it's, and I think that what makes it even more fucked up is that Ellie knows. I think when I first played the game, I didn't really pick up on that. I think there was a lot to digest, a lot that was going on, and I kind of missed the subtle hints that Ellie knows for sure.
Or she suspects. She strongly suspects that Joel is not telling the whole truth. That's probably the best way to phrase that.
Yeah, I think, I really think it's almost stronger than the suspicion, especially in the game, or I'm sorry, in the show, because she asks prodding and follow-up questions, right? Because Joel says, you know, she asks like why she's dressed like this. She still has on the hospital, not scrubs, but the patient. Whatever the patient.
Yeah, the
wears.
Scrubs. The gown.
The gown. Yes. She's still wearing that. She's like, why am I wearing this? You know, she starts asking. He's like, well, we had to get you out of there quickly because raiders came and attacked the hospital, and I had to get you out of there. And then she starts asking, well, were people hurt? is Marlene okay? And she's not asking that because she believes the Raider story, in my opinion. I think she's asking that because she's playing along kind of with his game and his lie and trying to say and trying to get more details. Like, what exactly did you do, man? Like, did what happened?
Yeah.
It's sad. It's sad because
it's heartbreaking.
What can she do? I mean, what can she do? She's just had this whole purpose ripped from her, and there's just nothing. That was a whole what else is there for her? And it kind of culminates in this final scene, right? Where she makes her stand and she says to him, like, I need to know. Like, first, let's talk about, I mean, we could talk about how she spills the beans about Riley.
About right? Riley. And we do get the confirmation that she was forced to kill Riley.
Yes. And she basically uses that as a way to explain, like, listen, like, I had to do this for Riley. I had to do this for Tess, all these other people that we've lost along the way. You know, I need to know, like, did you, it was this all for nothing? Like, truly, like, were the Fireflies truly not able to find a cure? Is what you're saying true? Or, you know, did you do something terrible? Did you do something unforgivable? And he doubled, Joel doubled down on it. And he says, yeah, everything is true. And Ellie delivers the one word line that hits me every single time I hear it or see it. And it's just the, okay, the resignation of, okay, fine. And
it's such a powerful, and this is why I loved in episode 6, where Joel gives Ellie the choice to choose him or Tommy. And he says, I'm older, I'm weaker, I'm slower. You'll be better off with Tommy. And Ellie says, I don't care. I feel safer with you. And there's no hesitation in that moment. She puts her trust in Joel to continue onward. There's full faith, full trust. She puts it in him. She makes that choice. Here, she doesn't really have a choice but to trust Joel, because if not, then her whole world collapses. And so there's so much behind that. Okay. Because it's like, I've put my trust and my faith in you so many times through necessity, through choice. And now it's like, if I don't do this, my whole purpose, my whole world collapses around me. Everything has been for nothing. And that's such a tenuous place to be. And it's such like a, this is why I love like bittersweet endings, because there was this collision course was there the whole time. Like, you don't know if Ellie and Joel are going to make it there safely, but the closer they get to their destination, the closer they get emotionally, the closer they get as, you know, as a pair, as a father, daughter, surrogate, and the more that bond coalesces, the harder it's going to be for Joel to part with her regardless of what happens. And so the writing is there on the wall to begin with, you know, like this train is set in motion from the beginning of the game. And all we can do is kind of watch it build to this kind of horrible conclusion where there's only really one possible outcome. And it's both good because they both live and they've kind of restored each other's worlds in a way, but it's not wholesome and it's not complete because it's balancing on a knife edge at the end. And that's basically, it's kind of like an Inception at the very end when the top is spinning, like Ellie saying, okay, the top is spinning and it's starting to rattle. And it's like, is it going to keep going? Is it going to topple? You have no idea, but you know, it's not stable.
Yeah. That's a great comparison, because it is the same. It plays on the same emotion as a viewer. It's just this anticipation of, you know, what's the resolution here? You know, it, like, is it all going to fall apart? It is kind of crazy to play a game with so much loss like this one and have both main characters live, right? And still, like, first of all, that in itself is a miracle. And then the fact that like you still almost feel like have unanswered questions and unresolved feelings about what happened. And those things will, you know, come to fruition in the future. But, you know, for now, and I just love that they ended it here, because I mean, they could have easily just added an extra scene. I think sometimes I'll read a book that's like this, where like, I wish that they end it right here at this moment. And then they'll go into town and, you know, they'll talk to Tommy and this thing. And that it's like, no, like, leave that to the imagination. Like, leave it here and give me the cliffhanger, you know, ending.
Yeah. Right?
So I do like unresolved and I shouldn't say unresolved endings. I mean,
it is a resolution to the story, but the character relationship that we spent so much time invested in is now kind of on a slope to destruction.
Yeah. And it hangs in the balance for sure.
It hangs in the balance. And there's, you know, that's basically like, you know, tiny little boulders that are eventually going to lead to an avalanche. Like that's not necessarily, you know, enough to say it's a loose or like it's a irresolute ending, because it's definitely like, this is the end of this part of the story. But it's enough to know that the story is not entirely over, if that makes sense.
Right. There's more to. I mean, it's so tricky too, because like, I mean, I guess this is like the age old like tragedies, right? This is like classic tragedy, like Shakespeare, like right?
It definitely feels like a Greek tragedy.
Yeah, exactly. This is where Shakespeare lived, right? This is like that's how he made his bones, and. It just feels like a classic story of that quality. I'm glad that this story exists, because it got me into, it got me back into reading. There was when this video game initially came out, I was kind of going through a period of my life where I just like stopped reading. I like read all throughout middle school, high school, elementary school, and then I just stopped in college. This got me interested in stories again. I'm like, God damn. I mean, I need to read something that's like, I gotta keep reading stuff that's like this or playing things that are like this. And, I'm just glad that we have this story. It's one of the best.
I think for me, The Last of Us highlights what I like about stories in general. I think sometimes people put overemphasis on uniqueness of plot, or, you know, plot twists, or, you know, too much on just an innovative story without putting any focus on the telling of that story, the way it's told, the structure, the characters, the consistency, the themes and the beauty. Like, so much about the telling of a story sometimes can be more important than the story itself. Because The Last of Us is not, you know, beat for beat is not an original story. It's a story that's been told in many different forms, even in the decade immediately preceding the release of the video game. It's just the way that it's told and the medium in which it's told that make it so revolutionary. You know, sometimes you can be revolutionary in the way you tell a story, even if the story itself is old. And I think that's what is The Last of Us is so important to me, is just the consistency, the honesty, the beauty, the merging of all of these disparate elements of storytelling weaved into one kind of beautiful piece of art is what I love so much about it.
Yeah. And I think we're lucky to have a, as I've, you know, consumed more, you know, interviews and different comments made from Neil Druckmann. I think we're lucky to have him as the mind behind this story. And that's probably why it is so good. Even though people like to bash him for whatever reason, I just think that he's somebody who understands that the story is his to be told, and, you know, he makes these hard decisions and, you know, maybe different than somebody has made in the past. And as long as he's got the chops to back it up and give you the proper payoffs, he shows that you can pull it off. And
yep.
I think we're lucky that we have him because he's not easily turned away from or swayed by the audience. And I think that that's a very good thing. So
he's got a very singular mind for storytelling, and he does a great job bringing his stories to life.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And yeah, this one's done. Right. This season done. Is done.
That's season one. We'll come back next week with our overall thoughts on the season. We might do a tabulated review. We might not. But we'll do a season one recap and then we'll go from there. But we've loved having you along the way. I love talking about this and can't wait for more Last of Us content.
Same here, buddy. And I can't wait to talk to you next week.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
See you guys.
Thanks again for tuning into the Cordyceps Crew podcast, an unofficial Last of Us podcast. If you made it this far into the episode and enjoyed what you heard, please leave a rating and a review wherever you might be listening. Want to reach out to us in person? Feel free to email us at cordycepscrew@gmail.com, and we may feature your comment in a future episode. You can follow us on all of our socials, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube for additional content and updates, all of which will be linked in the episode description. And that wraps it up for this week. We look forward to you joining us next week on this journey through The Last of Us. Thanks, guys.